How will we power our future? Can we create a healthy and clean economy? Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is at the forefront of the global debate about energy, economy, and the environment. Bringing together the brightest and most provocative leaders of our time, Climate One is the place where big ideas get heard. With thoughtful and insightful discussions on policy, business, science, and culture, Climate One founder Greg Dalton gets to the heart of the matter. It's our future. It's time to come together.
What did America learn from the BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico? Images of crude oil spewing from the ocean floor captivated the country and dominated the news in the spring of 2010. A lot of that seems to have now faded. In the summer of 2010, BP finally plugged the gusher, and in January of 2011, the National Oil Spill Commission, convened by President Obama, issued a report on government and industry failures that caused an estimated 170 million gallons of crude oil to be released into the ocean. I'm Greg Dalton, host of Climate One, and for the next hour with our live audience here at the Commonwealth Club, we'll discuss the Gulf oil disaster, and we're delighted to have the two chairmen of the President's National Commission here joining us. Please welcome Republican Bill Riley and Democrat Bob Graham to Climate One at the Commonwealth Club.
I really didn't introduce myself that way.
Gentlemen, thank you for coming.
I don't think I've ever been introduced quite that way, by the way. I'm Republican Bill Riley, but
yeah. Is that fact? Yeah, okay. Let's get right into this. Mr. Riley, when the report came out, you said that only systemic reforms in government and business could prevent a similar disaster. Are those systemic reforms happening?
The systemic reforms that we recommended are underway, certainly in the Interior Department, under the direction of Michael Bromwich and BOEMRE and Secretary Salazar. They really are. They've issued any number of new rules on safety and environmental management that are long overdue, I think, and very defensible, very professional, and very appropriate. They are also reorganized so that they have separated the fundraising or the revenue-generating part of oil and gas leasing from regulation on environment and safety. Those are very important. It hasn't happened statutorily because the Congress hasn't done it, but Secretary Salazar has done as much as he could do to accommodate the recommendation we made. I think a very promising and to some surprising response is the response of industry. The Center for Offshore Safety is basically coming together. They have had a couple of board meetings. They're going to interview two finalists for their executive directorship next week. They themselves have come around on a common safety and environmental management system. They've determined who can be a member, and they're going to include contractors in that as well, of this new organization, which is going to try to police itself, set standards. They're developing criteria for third-party audits, which is really a very important part of this process. That's a very promising response, and frankly, industry has done more than the Congress to respond to our report.
Bob Graham, what grade would you give the government and industry in terms of implementing the recommendations from the commission?
Well, probably in both places it would be incomplete, but I think the actions that have been taken at the executive level of the federal government are very encouraging. I think there are some things yet to do, such as fully implement the safety case approach to offshore safety as distinct from the current prescriptive process. The Congress would not get a very good grade because they essentially have done nothing. In some instances, have even gone backwards by shortening the time frame within which the Department of Interior's agencies have to review applications. So I would say incomplete, encouraging on the executive level, discouraging in Congress.
And some of the previous disasters, industrial disasters, Bhopal, Three Mile Island, had somewhat of a long-lasting and transformational effect. Is it too early to tell, or do we know if this disaster is going to have a similar impact on industry practice and oversight?
I'd say the comments that Bill has just made about the industry organizing its own internal safety is the most encouraging thing, that this event will not just pass into people's retreating memories, but rather will be seen as both a wake-up and an opportunity for reform. Things like this, such as the Three Mile Island for U.S. domestic nuclear and, on a global basis, the Bhopal industry, India for the chemical industry, have been wake-ups and have been the catalyst for major reform. It certainly is our hope that Macondo will have the same effect for offshore oil drilling.
Macondo being the lease area where the Deepwater Horizon was. Bill Ryan, do you think it will have similar impact, long-lasting impact, as some of those other industrial turning points?
Well, you know, Exxon Valdez was a crisis, a catastrophe in 1989, and it did really have profound effects on any number of responses. Double-hulled tankers came out of that, new liability caps, a very large fine and settlement, over $1 billion, got the attention of the industry. And the company that was most involved, it was Exxon Valdez, transformed itself, according to most industry observers, and became much more rigorous, in fact, perhaps the most rigorous with respect to environment and safety standards. So that has had a very salutary effect, particularly the government's response to it, I think, in that, and the countries. It will still take some time to see what the nature of the settlement is, where the money goes. One hopes it goes to restoration when it's finally allocated. Restoration of the very impaired areas of the wetlands, the productive fisheries resources of the southern Louisiana coast, for example. So I think the jury's still out a little bit on that. I have to say I'm a little disappointed that we moved on to another set of news concerns, quite understandably economic distress and banking scandals. But the industry certainly has to have received the message. And that's very important, and I think they are lifting up their game.
Well, you mentioned the settlement in Exxon Valdez, and that was in the courts for decades, for a long time. Give us an update on the settlement. You know, the money flows. There's different buckets of money, some from BP, some from federal fines. What's the latest on
that? Well, the settlement wasn't in the courts. That was agreed to between the United States and Exxon. $1.1 billion.
Okay.
A settlement and fine. That wasn't it. It was a suit by citizens in Alaska.
Civil action.
So yes.
Okay. So that,
yeah,
that took a long time.
Yes.
Right. And you were the administrator at that point, EPA administrator during part of that. So you
during
you
all said, of it, or yeah, during all of the government's part in it. Yes. The U.S. government.
Then where are the buckets of money in terms of the money flowing to victims? You know, the fish, shrimp, the shrimp farmers in the Gulf, those sorts of things. Are they getting? That was very much in the news, and now we've lost track of where that is.
There are going to be essentially three buckets of money. One was the $20 billion that BP put up early on, and which has gone to deal with immediate needs, such as the shrimp farmers and the and people who've been damaged in other economic and environmental manners. The second bucket is what's called WERDA, which is an act that was passed after Exxon Valdez, which uses a formula based on the amount of oil that was discharged to reimburse for more longer-range economic and environmental damage. And then the third bucket is the Clean Water Act, which is essentially a penalty, a punitive act, also based on the amount of oil discharged. That money is what we hope will be used primarily for restoration of the Gulf. Our commission and several other groups which have looked at this issue have recommended that up to 80% of the penalties coming through the Clean Water Act be directed towards Gulf restoration. There has been a project underway through the Environmental Protection Agency under the leadership of Lisa Jackson to try to develop what that plan would be. The Congress has not yet acted either on designating the 80% nor the specifics of the restoration plan.
So does that mean there's no money flowing yet, that it's bottled up in Washington?
Well, for the specific purpose of restoration, there is no money flowing yet.
Because I read recently that the president of the Louisiana Shrimp Association said their catch is down 80% this year. So there's people who are still feeling the... on the human side, and maybe that's not their restoration side.
I think the money has definitely moved through BP's $20 billion. is in the process of moving through this WERDA legislation, but the restoration is still waiting congressional action.
And it, how are the states? I mean, you also believe that there's some of the governors in the Gulf states have some differences about where the money ought to go. You're a former governor. Is there some tussling over where the money goes between states and perhaps the federal government?
Yes, and that's to be expected. Our position was that if you're going to justify earmarking 80% of this money for Gulf restoration, which otherwise would have gone essentially into the federal treasury, it ought to be used for Gulf restoration. The rationale for our recommendation included the fact that many of the problems that have occurred in the Gulf have been the result of federal action, such as the channelization of the Mississippi River has had a devastating effect on the wetlands in Louisiana, and therefore it's appropriate that the federal government make a major commitment towards Gulf restoration.
Bill Riley, do you have thoughts on where the money ought to go?
Well, we feel strongly that it should go substantially to restoration. The Senate Environment Public Works Committee has, in fact, recommended that. They have purported out. Frankly, I don't think that's going to happen unless the region gets together, unless the congressional representatives of the five states that are involved come together and agree, and the senators. They haven't yet. There are some issues that are a very important concern to a couple of governors that concern economic development priorities that they have. Probably economic development will be some reasonable part of any money that goes to the area, but if they do not agree, then I rather doubt the Justice Department would support all of those funds going, or even the substantial majority, to restoration. So time is running out on getting some kind of agreement, and it seems to me it's really in the interest of those who want to see restoration get the priority, and it's the only significant money that we're likely to see for a very beleaguered, very damaged environment in that region. And it's an exquisite environment. It's extremely important to recreation, fisheries, oil and gas, port activity, commerce. The only chance we're going to have in the near term, frankly, given the budget situation, is to get the funds that never were anticipated, were never part of anybody's plan, simply are the consequence of the disaster, directed toward the most urgent ecological restoration.
Of course, governors look at jobs and the next election, and they might want to understandably steer that towards something that get them more votes than...
You know, if it's on the scale of what we can anticipate, it's in the double-digit billions of dollars, there ought to be money to do a little of both, to do a little of economic development, but for the vast majority, go to ecological restoration, which has economic benefits. I mean, let's face it, that's where the substantial majority of fish are nourished, who then go out to the sea, and that's where their nurseries are.
And tourism can be benefited from
sure.
the cleanup.
Sure.
I would just slightly disagree with what Bill had just said. I think the other 45 states that are involved that are not one of the five Gulf states are going to play a role in here, particularly in this climate of budget constraint, mm-hmm. concerns about the deficit. We're talking about a fairly substantial amount of money being diverted from general purposes to the specific purpose of restoration. And my sense is, while I believe there is a political base for support for restoration, there's not going to be political support for what will be seen as just a backdoor form of earmarks or pork barrel for projects that are unrelated to the Macondo incident and unrelated to the long-term health of the Gulf of Mexico.
So given the political climate in Washington, one can see this getting bogged down and not being resolved, and neither the ecosystems or the workers down there getting any money.
That hasn't happened to any other issue I can think of.
Great confidence. If you're just joining us, our guests today at Climate One are Bill Riley, co-chair of the President's National Oil Commission, and former Senator Bob Graham, also co-chair of the National Oil Commission. Health impacts. There are people who are concerned about, you know, FDA testing of the shrimp down there. Do we know what the health impacts will be? NRDC put out a report saying that the FDA hasn't systematically tested the shrimp down there since October 2010. So we don't know what's in the shrimp, if there's potential long-term health concerns. Is that on anyone's radar?
I haven't seen any evidence that there has been any long-term threat to public health as a result of the event and the seafood, of which the Gulf of Mexico is one of the primary providers for the nation. I think, however, this issue goes into the same category as environmental damage, and that is to fully assess the health implications of this event and the environmental implications, we're going to require an extended period of time and a substantial investment in research. And we need to make that investment. That was another one of our recommendations, which thus far the Congress has not acted upon, so that this becomes a genuine learning experience and we won't have to repeat this in a future similar incident.
But if we're not doing testing, how are we going to know if there's health impacts?
That's exactly the question.
That's the point of the monitoring, which was a very important part of the settlement in Alaska in 1989, $100 million for research, for monitoring. And because of that, we know that there were substantial declines in fish catches in certain key areas. There were impacts on bird populations. We won't know that really definitively in the Gulf unless there's some systematic monitoring and research.
And that's not happening yet.
Not yet, not in, in any serious way. Some BP money has been used for that with some of the institutions down there, but the problem with monitoring is it's a long-term kind of proposition. You don't just do it once. You have to continue to do it to get a trend line, because also there are fish crashes that are unrelated to oil spills, and you want to get some reasonable preponderance of evidence if you're going to make some judgments about that. Unlikely, it seems to me, that a spill of this magnitude will not have consequences for some species for some time. The states were doing monitoring out to 3 miles of oysters, for example, and clams. Food and Drug Administration, Center for Disease Control, was doing monitoring farther out. They have been reasonably, and I personally went into this at one point when we heard some complaints from Vietnamese fishermen, particularly in the region of Louisiana, they had not found problems or concentrations of hydrocarbons in fish tissue. Mm-hmm. That's what they were looking for. So there's something of a difference of opinion about how thorough the testing was, whether it was spread around significantly enough, and because it's a very large area of the Gulf that was affected. But that's something that over time we should be able to resolve.
One of the recommendations of the of your commission also was that the oil and gas industry follow a precedent from the nuclear industry in terms of setting that up. And is that the organization that you referred to?
Center for Offshore Safety.
So you think that they are following the nuclear industry, and that will be one of the success points of the lessons really applied from this?
The Institute for Nuclear Power Operations, which was established after Three Mile Island, really did improve the performance, monitoring, inspections of the nuclear industry without reference to government. They simply recognized their self-interest, as I think the oil industry has. One of these things happens again, it won't just be maybe 37 rigs that are shut down in the Gulf, or 31 rigs, but maybe the industry will be shut out of the Gulf for a while, for some time to come. They, I think, recognize that. And so they are establishing something more or less on the model of the Institute for Nuclear Power Operations. It's more difficult to do. There are a lot more operators. There are a lot more contractors. It's a more complex, variegated kind of industry. But they're going to have third-party audits, and they're going to have the capability of saying, as somebody should have said to BP before this all happened, we're calling you out.
Because you're putting all of us at risk.
You're putting us at risk by not putting adequate attention and priority on the process safety. And we've already seen evidence of it in Texas, at Texas City, where a refinery exploded, and then up in Alaska a year later, where 5,000 barrels went out onto the snows because of failure to maintain their pipeline. So people should have known, and it turns out people in industry did know.
Right.
Some of them actually went to the CEO of BP to try to get a correction, unsuccessfully. This should create the capacity to make sure that everybody comes up to a common standard of best practice, and those who don't are kicked out of the club. That would have consequences, obviously, to the regulator as
well. BP says they were not grossly negligent. Were they?
We were asked by the president in our charter, creating the Oil Spill Commission, not to get into that. We assigned cause, but we did not determine liability. But, so I won't get in. There's a very large.
But the commission doesn't exist anymore, right? So you you can say
that. I won't get into characterization of whether it was negligence or gross negligence. That has huge financial consequences. I'll leave that to the Justice Department, which I understand is beavering away on it.
Senator Graham?
Probably the most controversial statement in our report was that this was a systemic failure. There are many people who would like to say this was a failure of BP and its contractors. The rest of the industry should be left untouched. The reality is one, we found that the industry itself had significant problems. The fact that there was no response capability after the event, and it took 2 months to cap the well, is an indictment of the industry's capability. Second, the fact that in a very formidable environment, the North Sea, for every one death on their offshore rigs, we have four deaths in the Gulf of Mexico, some indicator of a differential in safety. Second is the fact is the consequences of this can't be confined. I spoke recently at an oil conference in Abu Dhabi, and people from all over the world were talking about the fact that this incident in the Gulf of Mexico was having an effect on them, their relationship with their governments and their regulatory policies. So the industry is increasingly accepting the fact that they're all in this together, mm-hmm. and that the tendency will be to judge them by the outlier with the lowest standards of safety, and then the whole industry gets painted with that brush. It's very encouraging what Bill has just reported about the industry's response in setting up an independent industry safety watchguard.
If you're just joining us on the radio, our guests today at Climate One are co-chairs of the President's Commission on the Oil Spill in the Gulf of Mexico, Bill Riley and Bob Graham. I'm Greg Dalton. Let's talk about one more thing from the past and look to the future about where pivot into the future, and that is a liability cap. One issue about is that the liability cap is, what, $50, $70 million in countries. Is that high enough? And if this industry is really going to get together and really manage its risk, that should drive down the cost of insurance, and they shouldn't be so concerned about a higher cap because it won't cost that much if they're really doing everything that this industry group is supposedly going to do.
One thing that the neighbors in the Gulf were very fortunate is that this happened to a company of BP's financial strength. This had happened to a marginal exploration company that took advantage of the $75 million cap. There would have been enormous distress, uncompensated, among the other users of the Gulf of Mexico and its terrestrial neighbors. We recommended that the cap be lifted. Personally, I think that it should be lifted in a subjective way. There are some places where the risk is clearly minimal, such as shallow water drilling where we've had lots of experience. There are other places, such as an 18,000-foot drill in the that BP was undertaking at Macondo, that are very risky. So if there's going to be a liability cap, in my judgment, it should vary with the degree of actual risk that particular operation imposes.
I would just add that the $75 million cap is not the last word. If there is a catastrophe, there are Clean Water Act penalties. If there's gross negligence, they're $4,300 a barrel. If it's negligence, it's, I think, $1,100 a barrel. That adds up if it's a big spill, obviously. The state has legal action that it can take under its own laws. It's not affected by the cap. So probably for many medium-sized operator, it's a life-threatening consequence. It's probably going to bankrupt the company even now with the $75 right. million dollar cap. $75 million as a symbolic number is, you know, it was set 20 years ago. It ought to be revisited. There's some, we didn't have time to go into the details on how that should be done in our 6 months, but we did notice the cap is significantly lower in Canada, and it's lower in the North Sea. So getting some parity on that, given that they're the same companies operating everywhere,
right.
really seems to me makes sense, and perhaps some kind of international both standard setting for, certainly for deep water and for ecologically sensitive areas like the Arctic, and then standards for the liability might be appropriate internationally.
Well, let's talk about the Arctic. That's the future. Right now, there's a lot of controversy about potential drilling for oil and gas up there. There's tremendous reserves in the Arctic. It's what are the risks up there? It's far away from a lot of response capabilities, but there's tremendous resources up there. Bill Riley?
Well, we recommended that a number of steps be taken to try to improve the assurance that any drilling in that very fragile, very rich in terms of fisheries and other resources area be protected against. And one is to bring the Coast Guard's response capability a little closer than 1,000 miles away, which is where it is right now from the Chukchi Sea. Secondly, to increase the capability to conduct some kind of spill response. We have not had a large-scale demonstration that you can do an effective spill response in Arctic fractured ice situations. It's a very sensitive area. On the other hand, and Shell would make the point, that they have done more than is required by regulation.
Shell's the company that has a big lease up there right now.
Shell has a big lease. They've spent a couple of $1 billion more on developing that lease, which is several years old, and feel that they should have been allowed to go forward to do the exploration. And if they have, as they say they will have, a series, it's basically their own flotilla of response, including a ship that can take a substantial amount of oil on board itself. It's shallow water largely, 140, 160 feet. Doesn't have the pressures that we had in the Gulf in a very deep formation. It won't require robots to go down and do any repairs, and they promised to cease drilling at least a month before the onset of ice. I would make a distinction myself between exploratory drilling and production drilling. I think they have the technology and properly supervised and regulated can use it to do exploration. Be nice to know what's there before we go any further up there. But I don't myself have the sense that the technology really exists for full season production drilling.
Is that what some of the companies want?
Well, eventually if they find enough. But that may not be as large a problem, because basically the industry's view is, well, look, we won't really develop that technology unless it turns out that it's really remunerative to do it. But developing the Chukchi Sea, you know, you've got about 300 or 400 miles of pipeline that will have to be built to bring it down to the Trans-Alaska pipeline. It'll be a while before we see any effects there. In terms of production drilling, I think that will probably be even longer. The Beaufort Sea is where the attention has been going, and the administration has been gradually granting the permits to go ahead and do the exploration. There's already significant production coming by BP and among others in the Beaufort Sea. So there is a series of things, and one important long-term priority, I think, ought to be to look at the resources. You know, it's really warming up there. There's going to be a lot more ocean traffic, ship channel traffic there. There are likely more impacts on the whales and other species from warming, and also from the traffic. To have serious multi-season monitoring of the species, what their life cycle is like, where they are, how they migrate, and at what times of the year, when they're most threatened by certain kinds of activities, whether it's sonar activity or ship channel activity or oil and gas dredging. Be nice to know all of those things over a long period of time. I think that can be done while a certain amount of exploration goes on, but it really is something we ought to do.
So parallel, Bob Graham?
Yeah, one other thing that the Arctic demonstrates, and that is it is not the exclusive domain of any one country. In fact, there are multiple countries that claim parts of the Arctic. There's the beginning of some regional discussions to arrive at common standards and a response capability among the countries which share the Arctic. The same thing is now happening between the United States and Mexico, and maybe even eventually Cuba, the countries that are doing drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. I think that regional approach is an important but not necessarily complete answer. But if we get some experience with these regional compacts, then I think we can look towards what Bill mentioned earlier, an international set of standards, particularly for deep water offshore drilling.
And none of us have been concerned about Russia, which is likely to be the first into the Arctic. Their representatives who came to the Interior Secretary's ministerial conference were probably the most explicit and the most reassuring about the degree to which they take the threat seriously and are guarding against them. So I think some of us were pleasantly surprised by that. And Putin himself has made statements along those lines. But there needs to be some common understanding. If there were a catastrophe, we ought to respond to someone else's as they ought to help respond to ours. It's very much in everybody's interest, and the waters flow among all of these countries in the Arctic, as they do in the Gulf, of course, to work together.
Yeah, the fish don't know if it's Russian territory or Canadian territory.
Probably not.
If you're just joining us, our guests today at Climate One are Bill Riley, co-chair of the National Oil Commission, and Senator Bob Graham, another co-chair of the National Oil Commission. Let's talk about how much we ought to be moving away from fossil fuels. Bob Graham, you just returned from Abu Dhabi, and you have some views about moving away from petroleum and toward renewable energy.
One of the interesting things happening in that part of the world is a recognition that oil is finite. A place like Dubai, for instance, has now virtually depleted the oil that it one time had, and that was a contributor to some of its recent financial problems. They've had to look to their neighbor, Abu Dhabi, as the source of financing to finish many of the big projects that were underway in Dubai. There are other places in the Middle East that are thinking about what their after oil economy and societies will be like and are making some preparations. Abu Dhabi, which I know best because of the time I've recently spent there, they are not only investing in a sustainable village, which is going to demonstrate how that society could operate without the use of fossil fuels. They also are investing heavily in culture. There is currently underway a Guggenheim museum by Frank Gehry. The Louvre is building an annex, and there's a performing arts center which frankly makes the Sydney Opera House look like a big box store. And all of that is being done because they recognize that they've got to have another economy, and they see tourism with culture as a major attraction as being part of that post-oil economy. What concerned me was I don't see the United States engaged in any serious thinking about what its economy is going to be in the post-oil era.
Bill Riley, you're on the board of one of the largest oil companies in the country. I'd like to, ConocoPhillips, I'd like to ask you about this quote from the chief economist at the International Energy Agency, who the main energy authority for developed countries, Fatih Birol, said that one day we will run out of oil. It is not today or tomorrow, but one day we will run out of oil, and we will have to leave oil before oil leaves us. And we have to prepare ourselves for that day. The earlier we start, the better. What do you think about that?
You know, I've been in the renewables business, and one of the things we really have learned is we cannot count on oil running out and its price going up to make renewables attractive, to make them competitive. We've got to take policy action to make them competitive. We need nationally a renewable portfolio standard. That is a minimum percentage of renewables that must be the component of any electricity generation. We have it in 35 states. It's in various stages, anywhere from 12 up to 20%. California's going to try to go to 30. That, I think, can make a huge difference. For coal, is which I'm most focused on, more focused on than oil. In terms of the oil reduction potential, we've got opportunities we never had before. We're going to have a 54 mile per gallon automobile fuel efficiency requirement, CAFE standard. We have now hybrids, which offer us tremendous possibilities if their power is not all channeled into speed, if it's channeled into conservation and efficiency. I think there's a large opportunity for natural gas powered vehicles to fleet. Some of the major fleet owners are experimenting with those, and for electric vehicles. Those, I think, are going to come on. Transportation is really the issue if you look at oil usage, and we've got to bring it down by more efficiency in how we power our cars and trucks.
Another International Energy Agency expert, the chief economist, said that he saw huge potential for biofuels, which could account for 25% of transportation, liquid transportation fuels by 2050. Are you also bullish on biofuels?
I am, and I just spent several hours yesterday in Wilmington, Delaware, reviewing biofuels research. It is very close to producing a competitive cellulosic ethanol, which will take a little pressure off the feed grains, for example, that now are powering our ethanol. It's not there yet. It's complex in terms of the kind of enzymes that have to be used and the cost of the refineries and the reactions and so forth. But we're getting there, and I do think over time we will be able to use corn stover, cellulosic ethanol, and maybe some other switchgrass crops that basically are not going to take from the food supply on marginal land, for example, and begin to move them into the liquid fuels. That would could make a significant difference, along with the efficiency requirements of the cars, in our oil import bill and in our impact on the climate.
One of the challenges in getting there is price competitive, but also doing it at the scale that people under, there's the billions of gallons of liquid transportation fuels that are consumed, and it's one thing to have a bathtub experiment in a laboratory, it's another thing to build industrial facilities that can make...
Well, that's what we learned. That's quite right.
And are you saying that the industrial scaling capacity and the financing costs are also getting close?
They are getting close, and in fact, the really encouraging thing about renewables is if you look at the combination of the degree to which biofuels are looking like they're going to be competitive within 2 to 3 years, for one thing, and then you look at the plummeting price of solar panels, largely caused by the Chinese having entered this in big time and used their stimulus money to do it, that too is beginning to look more and more competitive for certain kinds of areas of the country. We need one further breakthrough. We need breakthrough on storage. And if we had a breakthrough, whether it's through air compression or whatever, of storing underground, we could deal with the reality still, which is even in the windiest parts of Texas, which is about as windy as most places in the country, when you build new wind power, and they built more of it than any other state, you still have to have almost 40% of your power capability, your capacity, in natural gas, just because the wind doesn't always blow. If we could store it, then we would have overcome that. And there are a lot of people working on storage now.
And some of the biggest investors in this area are the actual oil companies who are, in a sense, investing in companies that want to replace their or compete with their core product, Shell.
More power to them.
Yes, exactly.
That's what we want to see. That's what,
because they have
they
the scaling
have the resources.
And the scaling capacity, industrial engineers to
exactly.
do that.
Well, I think it's very much in the self-interest of the existing energy companies to get involved. There's a story I think it's true, maybe mythical, that there was a dinner held in New York at the end of the 19th century with the presidents of all the major railroads, and they were asked this question: what business are you in? And each person at the dinner gave the same answer: we're in the railroad business, which consigned their companies to ultimate bankruptcy. Had they been creative, they would have seen automobiles and trucks,
transportation business,
aviation, et cetera. They would have broadened their horizon as to what business they were in and probably would have been profitable industries up to today. Mm-hmm. So I think the oil industry is very wise to be avoiding that trap of a narrow definition of what business they're in.
Bob Graham is a co-chair of the President's National Oil Spill Commission. He's also here with Bill Riley and the other co-chair of the National Commission. I'm Greg Dalton. Bill Riley, you mentioned policy drivers need to make alternatives competitive with fossil fuels. And renewable electricity standard is for electricity. What policy would you like to see to make liquid transportation fuels competitive with petroleum?
Well, we have a number of supports, and there has been stimulus money go into liquid fuels, alternatives to petroleum, to fossil fuels. I think that's very important. I'll tell you, down the line, either we get some kind of cap and trade or we get a tax on carbon. One of the interesting things about the budget negotiations is nobody likes the idea of a tax on anything, but when you look at the alternatives of where you would put some kind of revenue enhancing capability, some kind of carbon tax looks the least disruptive and the most practically justifiable in terms of its public policy consequence. Australia has just moved along to do that. I think that's a very good example for us to take. Australia is a country that's got a lot of coal, exports a great deal of coal, is always in the negotiations on climate, has always stood with the United States defending those interests. It's moving now, I think, largely because of the consequence of their drought last summer, which was really searing, devastating. That's a model that we might follow, and I hope that the budget negotiators will give a serious look at it.
Canada, also British Columbia, Alberta, also have carbon taxes, other democracies. Bill Graham, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, and I would comment that one other thing that Australia has in common with the United States, they had their own major disaster. It occurred about 8 months before Macondo. It was called the Monterra. In fact, there were an eerily number of similarities between those two incidents, and that probably contributed to their recognition that they need to have a more aggressive policy of developing alternatives.
Mm-hmm. And how about the subsidies for fossil fuels? They've had 100 years to build up all sorts of complicated production tax credit, investment tax credit. You know, if you're Jed Clampett and want to drill in your backyard, you get all sorts of benefits that you don't get if you put up solar or wind, that sort of thing. Should we address the subsidy issue?
Yeah, I agree with Bill that in the short run, if we're going to have a sustainable energy industry, it's going to have some kind of protection, because we can't wait until the time that the industry can compete on pure economics with fossil fuel. But I believe that we ought to have as a national direction to begin to reduce the amounts of subsidies across the board, including in the petroleum industry, in order to at some point allow the marketplace to decide who the winners or losers are in this new energy economy.
Even in this polarized political environment, we saw some consensus around that on corn ethanol recently, where people came together and said, should we really continue the corn ethanol subsidies? I don't know if that actually got all the way through, but it got some support from Republicans and Democrats in the Senate saying, why are we doing this?
Yeah, there was a senator from Oklahoma, a big oil state. Apparently, most of that subsidy didn't end up in the pockets of the farmers. It ended up in the pockets of the petroleum companies, who were subsidized to encourage them to use ethanol in their mixture. And this senator made the point, if we've given a tax preference to achieve a specific purpose, and if that purpose has been achieved and no longer requires the tax preference to accomplish it, should we not eliminate that preference? And he argued that this was not a tax increase. This was rather in the nature of a rational appreciation of the appropriate use of tax policy for broader economic and social policy. And once the objective had been achieved, the subsidy should be removed.
Bob Graham is co-chair of the President's National Oil Commission. Our other guest today at Climate One is Bill Riley, also co-chair of the President's National Oil Commission. We are going to put a microphone up here and invite audience participation. If you're on this side of the audience, we'd appreciate you going around to the other side and forming the line over there. So please, a lot of this really counts on audience participation. We'd like to hear your comments and questions. One-part question. If you need some help keeping it brief, I'll be happy to help. Yes.
Yes, good morning. Gentlemen, thank you for all of your work on these issues. The question I have is perhaps just a tiny bit outside of exactly what you were charged to do. But as you have mentioned, there are other countries involved, and this was the Gulf of Mexico. Have you had expressions of concern or questions or suggestions from the government of Mexico regarding this bill?
Yes, we have. And we went to Mexico with Secretary Salazar Secretary of the Interior to address that, and essentially to try to get them to agree to a common set of standards, to engage with the United States. We found a warm welcome and complete agreement that the threats that we all share are important to them. They are going to go into very deep water. They're doing so this year and will continue to, and they have a large area of sovereign water that they're responsible for. They are actually agreeing to implement BOEMRE, U.S. Interior Department standards for regulating, And I had asked earlier, while we were still doing the oil spill commission, I had asked my the regulator in Mexico if they would go to the Cubans, with whom they have a close relationship and have long had diplomatic relations, to try to get them to do something equivalent. They agreed to that. I then later went to Cuba last month, and when I suggested that Cuba copy Mexico, thinking that probably it might be more acceptable to them than to talk about the United States, they said, we are reading every day what comes out of the Interior Department of the United States, and we're going to do everything that they're prescribing. So the Cubans, who are going into deep water next month, deeper than Macondo, by the way, and that will be the first of six wells they will drill over the next 2 years, they are attentive to the risks. They don't want to make the mistakes that they've seen us make. On the other hand, they've never had offshore oil and gas development of any consequence before, so this is a first for them. In my view, they're taking most of the precautions, trying to get their engineers trained in Brazil, a couple of hundred of them. They've gone to Norway, where they have studied the safety case, which Bob Graham mentioned earlier here. The safety case, which is the Norwegian gold standard for regulation, which our commission recommended to the United States, that has not yet been accepted, so that we have some expectation that there will be a common set of standards in the Gulf. There is a problem, however, with our sanctions, in that if they should need a capping stack, for example, which is what finally stopped the flow at Macondo, BP, there are two of them in the Gulf, both of them in U.S. waters, in the United States, and under present sanctions interpretation, they cannot be transported to Cuba to deal with a catastrophe. I have every confidence that any president would interpret the sanctions to permit that. We'd be much better if, looking ahead, that simply was understood in term, and also that their blowout preventer, which has 10% U.S. components by statutory maximum, could get serviced and spare parts when it needs it, which under present sanction law apparently it can't do, or sanction policy. Some of those things have to be corrected, I think, and it's in the interest of the United States and in the interest of protecting Florida and Key West particularly, which is about 60 miles from where this drilling is going to take place, to provide that assurance.
Governor Graham, your constituency in Florida, some of the strongest supporters of that embargo on Cuba. Do you see that kind of accommodation happening?
Well, I think that we've had other areas of cooperation, such as in weather service, hurricane analysis and preparation. And I think this is going to be another in that category. It is so much in the interest of the United States and specifically of Florida to, A, avoid an incident, and if there is one, to be able to respond quickly. The Gulf Stream runs right adjacent to the area that the Cubans will be drilling in. Any spill is going to immediately endanger a significant amount of the east coast of the United States, starting with Florida. So there's such an interest, common interest in safety, that I believe this will be another area in which we will find the basis of cooperation.
Let me add something on that. I learned in Cuba that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the U.S. Coast Guard were in regular contact with Cuba during the Macondo disaster, informing them about the volume of oil that was being released, the water flows, the movement of it. So that was just done informally and as an efficiency and a courtesy for which Cuba was very grateful. So the pattern of just common sense exchange of information about something so vital to the United States as safety and environmental protection for Florida and the other states, I think there's a precedent for it now.
We're discussing the National Oil Commission at one at the Commonwealth Club. Did you want to ask a question? I'm not sure if you're... Okay, any other audience questions? We took our mic away. Shy audience this morning. I'm really surprised. Oh, sure, let's bring the mic back.
I know some of them. They're not all shy.
maybe with you here. The one question is that whether we have a lot of people here who have been in political office before, and they seem to be a lot more reasonable once they're out of political office than those who are
funny
in.
That.
Funny how that works. And so the question is whether the things we're talking about, things are so polarized and poisoned in Washington. Do you see this as a trend that can be perhaps subside, or can we ever come together across the aisle to deal with these issues?
Well, we must come together. Our society cannot operate without a heavy dose of reason to compromise. Part of the advantage that we had is the president selected all seven members of our commission, and he selected them both for the diversity of backgrounds that they represented, but also because of at least his confidence that we would be able to come together collegially and arrive at some conclusions as to cause and recommendations for the future. Another benefit that we had is we spent a lot of time together. Bill and I almost became twin brothers at one point. That is not something which most political office holders have the luxury of doing. In fact, it's become a diminishing commodity in Washington. So I think there may be some lessons from our experience that have broader application not only in the oil and gas industry, but also in the political community.
Big camping trips for Republicans and Democrats to get away and spend some time.
Well, that, you know, that may sound frivolous, but...
No, I'm serious. They, you know, get away from their handlers and their bases. Yeah. And
A former senator from Florida who was a good friend of my father's once said that the thing that killed the U.S. Senate was the jet airplane, because it allowed everybody to leave town on the weekends, whereas in the pre-jet airplane era, members of Congress stayed in Washington, and the weekends were not just frittered away. They were used to develop personal relationships, which then reflected themselves when they were back on Monday doing their political business.
Let's have our next audience question.
Hi there. Catherine Decker, Birdsong Strategy Group. I just wanted to ask you about the quality of the ecosystem in the Gulf as it currently stands. You had mentioned that there is very little, that maybe there was no monitoring past October of last year on the shrimp, the health of the shrimp population. One of the things I recently became aware of is that dolphins in the Gulf are dying at a rate of 10 times the rate they died prior to the spill. And that seems to be an indicator of something amiss within the Gulf and the things that the dolphins depend on, i.e. fish. So it's curious to me that there may not be any ongoing monitoring going on. And so I'm wondering, is there no scheduled ongoing monitoring right now of the Gulf? Completely dependent upon NGOs to make these observations?
Well, the fact is that there needs to be a significant and sustained commitment of resources to that ongoing monitoring, and that's what we don't have. We certainly have the scientific capability to do effective monitoring. There's an understanding of the importance and need to do it. It's the absence of the resources that's the current constraint.
Bill Riley?
My impression has been that there has been reasonably good monitoring. I mean, given the huge size of the Gulf and the daunting challenge of doing it by CDC, by the Center for Disease Control and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, with regard to food safety, the Food and Drug Administration has been involved with that as well. And most of those reports that I have seen are reassuring. They are questioned by some who say, well, they're partial, they're not expansive enough, they may have missed certain coastal areas, and they don't come close to shore typically. The United States is not doing the testing 3 miles for the first 3 miles, I understand, which is where a lot of the shellfish are. And I don't really know how often the states are testing for that. As far as monitoring of fish populations, their health, their vitality, and the rest, I think it's sort of hit or miss. I don't think there's been any systematic efforts to try to resolve those questions. There are a whole range of species that were in the area that was affected by the spill. That's really where we need serious long-term financial commitment to substantial, respected institutions to see season in season and out of season for a number of years what's happening there. I've seen those stories, heard about them on the dolphin collapse. So far, nobody's willing to say, well, that's a consequence of the spill, or that's a consequence of the sea level or the sea temperature warming, which is also happening. We just don't know the answer to that question. You never resolve some of those things definitively, but you can go a long way if you have a program that's designed really to to be systematic, inclusive, and long-term.
Bill Riley is a co-chair of the President's National Oil Commission. Our other guest today at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is Bob Graham, and I'm Greg Dalton. When Senator Feinstein was here recently, she said that this United States could basically have a regional policy toward offshore drilling. California and the West Coast has said, look, we don't want any drilling. The Gulf states, they want drilling because they see jobs and they see the economic opportunity. Is that a reasonable approach to have a differing regional strategy to offshore oil drilling where some like it, some don't?
Well, we have had that in the Gulf. There has been extensive drilling in the Western and Middle Gulf. There has not been in the Eastern Gulf, largely because of a decision that Florida made at the state level, and that was that it would not drill in its nearshore waters and that it would discourage the federal government from drilling in its waters that were adjacent to those Florida nearshore waters. The reality is that the land that is beyond the state's control, it belongs to all the people of the United States and is ultimately going to be its use will be determined by the representatives from all of the United States.
That essentially was the rationale of the first President Bush, who declared the offshore oil areas along the Pacific coast, substantial other areas, other parts of the country, to be off limits to oil and gas development.
Do we have another audience question? Yes.
I just want to go back to a question that I think was asked but maybe not fully answered, which is policies that can be enacted at the federal and state level and even at the local level that would help the country move off our oil addiction. And if you could maybe address that a little bit further, I'd appreciate that.
Well, I think Bill has given a number of illustrations of what that would include. There's another issue, and that is the infrastructure that supports it. I am about to start driving an electric car, and one of my concerns is that if I want to go beyond a fairly short distance, I need someplace to be able to refuel my electric car. So part of the solution to this problem is going to be developing the infrastructure that will make these forms of transportation that are non-traditional by today's standards pragmatically acceptable for large numbers of Americans. And I think that is going to be primarily at the state and local level to establish those networks of support.
And we're seeing here, San Francisco is not a typical American city, but we're seeing increasing numbers of electric cars, pure electric cars, here on the streets in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So it is starting to happen. Mm-hmm. Bill Riley?
The range problem, the limited range, has been the obstacle to a lot of people's decision to buy an electric vehicle. And that's why I think the intermediate vehicle of choice is going to be a hybrid. Where you're able to have a supplement in terms of mileage that goes beyond 70 or 100 miles if you need that kind of range. That technology is around. It's been developed. It's been perfected. The batteries are sufficient to sustain it. And I think that will be the way we will edge into fully electric vehicles. In terms of the kinds of vehicles that really are not affected by the range limitations, so many service vehicles, so many fleet vehicles, so many buses, for example, taxis and the rest, we should be moving all of those to the extent we can, I think, into electricity.
And that is happening. PepsiCo and Frito-Lay and some of those companies are starting to FedEx deploy pure electrics and hybrid electrics as they go back, and they know what their range is on any given day. Before we wrap up here, I want to circle back to, we kind of skated over peak oil, and it sounds like, Bob Graham, you believe that peak oil, that the oil supplies will be diminishing, or certainly that prices will increase over time. And Bill Riley, it sounds like you think that that's not the case.
Five, 6 years ago, we had what we thought was a relatively well-understood, somewhat finite and limited amount of natural gas in the country. The economy's totally changed. It isn't that nature produced a lot more natural gas. It's that now we have the technology and the cost is come down to using it. Horizontal drilling, fracturing, all the rest we know about. The same is happening with respect to oil. And that's why I say, as someone who's watched over a long period of time and thought that we gradually were getting an intersection of cost reductions for renewables with rising costs of fossils, it isn't the way it's going to happen. Natural gas costs somewhere in the range of $4 per million cubic feet right now.
Historically cheap.
Historically very, very cheap. And if you're competing with that to provide electricity, you want to do it with renewables, you've got to have some help. You've got to have a renewable standard that is applied in the state, and you've got to have some other tax and preferential treatment in the tax law provided by the federal government. You've just got to have that. That's what's going to be necessary. There's every reason to do it. We've done it for other industries. We did it for oil and gas.
Bob Graham?
Well, I think the question is not whether it's going to happen. It's when is it going to happen, and what does that sense of urgency say about our preparation? During the 20th century, the most depleted nation in the world in its oil supply was the United States of America, because for a long period, we not only were serving our own needs, we were exporting substantial amounts of oil to Europe, particularly in the years immediately after World War II. We still have lots of oil and even more natural gas in the United States, but it's not unlimited. And so I think that a sensible policy would begin the process of thinking about what kind of economy, what kind of society are we going to have at that point in time, and get ready for it before the last drop is drawn out of the lands of the United States.
Bill Reilly, even if there is expanding supply, technology makes new fields available, some people would say that cheap oil is over, that the oil that's still out there is deeper, it's more expensive to get to, and it requires more net energy to drill deeply. So it requires a big chunk of a barrel of oil in production to extract it to get it out. So would you accept that net energy and perhaps there'll be some upward pressure on supply just because of where it's located? And it's
yeah, I think it is. I think the projection is something like $95 a barrel next year. Nobody can predict that with any kind of certainty. I guess my view is that we've got to kick the dependency on fossil fuels. That's really got to be the objective. Not because we're running out of fossil fuels, but because continuing to use them at the rate we are and at the rate that other countries around the world are going to use them is simply going to devastate our climate. That's the reason we've got to move on this. My point really was that we can't count on the cost of fossil fuels working to help us achieve that objective.
We'll have to end it there. Our thanks to Bill Reilly and Bob Graham, co-chairs of the President's National Oil Commission. I'm Greg Dalton. Thank you for joining us on the radio and on TV at Climate One of the Commonwealth Club. All right.